You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Tuesday, October 21st, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times, the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. On today's program, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist from the New York Times, on his new book, Pay Any Price, Greed, Power, and Endless War, James Risen will be with us on the program today. Also on the program, less than 2 weeks until the midterm elections, war on voting continues. Meanwhile, speaking of continuing, the constant hype of Ebola fears in this country, will it ever abate? And how a little school in New Jersey proves my point about the Sam Harris debate. Meanwhile, a Pew report comes out with a fascinating look on what media liberals and conservatives trust. You can probably guess the results. Mitch McConnell. Get ready, folks. Are you interested in going on all expenses paid bus cruise with the McConnell people? We'll give you information. Michelle Bachmann, 24-hour security because of an ISIS threat. And today in the better half, we will introduce a new segment. This guy's problems with me, Sam Steeder. Maybe it should be that guy's problems. All on today's program. A couple of housekeeping notes. A, you should know that Michael is working the board right now because Matt is en route to a hit on MSNBC about Gamergate. So if there's a massive technical problems, you understand why that would be the case. As Michael is on the case. Don't do that.
That was intentional.
Yes, I know that was intentional. Yeah. Also, just FYI, as you know, we have to move our office, and we've had to do so with a very limited time frame. We have located and now I've got the keys and internet at the new office. I will be taking a Thursday. Matt and Mike will be here to do the show as we prep. And then the big move, where we will have probably just members archive shows, will happen Wednesday and Thursday of next week. And then on Friday, it's Halloween, and you know what that means if you're a longtime listener, what we do around here. So, folks, the move is obviously going to tax us both in terms of our physical resources, or I should say our human resources, as limited as they are, although I want to confirm that we're all human here. But also our financial resources, and hopefully we're going to be able to get our stuff together and do a formal fundraiser to help us with this move and to broaden what we offer in the media world. But in the meantime, it is our members that make this show possible. So if you have the financial means to support this program, please do so today. Go to majority.fm, click on Become a Member. If you'd rather, go to jointhemajorityreport.com. It takes you to the same page. We were very clever in getting a separate URL in that manner. So please, by all means, use it. You can also support this program by buying your Amazon crap through our Amazon link at majorityreportkickback.com. Click on the link, bookmark it, use it for your Amazon stuff. You'll notice no difference. We get a kickback. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee. It's a great company. They're employee owned. The coffee's delicious. A lot of different varieties. You can get the Majority Report blend, which is, frankly, my favorite blend. That's why we chose it as the Majority Report blend. And use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, James Risen. You got to play music. I thought you were going to handle that. All right, you want me to do that?
You said you were going to do it.
No.
Sorry. I got it.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program James Risen, Pulitzer Prize winning reporter with the New York Times. Author, his latest is Pay Any Price, Greed, Power, and Endless War. Welcome to the program, James.
Thanks for having me.
Now, obviously, and I think hopefully people are familiar with your situation legally and the 6-year pursuit now of and your involvement in a national security case. I want to get to that, but I want to start first with your book, because what has struck me, and we've spoken on this program to Thomas Drake and other whistleblowers, and it was in my conversation with Thomas Drake that this idea, which you've really explored, I think, in this book, of what how the national security apparatus is abused. And it seems to me, and I think your book basically follows this, there is a spectrum when we talk about the national security state, running from thieves to con men to sort of kickbacks, and then profiteering, then career ambition, and then that takes us up to keeping us safe.
And then
maybe on the other side of that is whistleblowers, which circle back around at the beginning. So let's start with on that spectrum of thieves. One of the things, I mean, overall, your book is about what has really happened, really what has happened under the guise of the war on terror that has lasted now 13 years. Let's start with thieves, because one of the things you cover in your book is just this amazing story of that starts at in the New York area with pallets of $100 bills shrink wrapped.
Right. Yeah, I mean that in that case, the U.S. government, the Bush administration, right after the U.S. invasion of Iraq, decided to send about $14 billion in cash to Iraq from the United States, from the New York Federal Reserve East Rutherford cash currency facility. And they had convoys of trucks, went down the New Jersey Turnpike from East Rutherford and loaded all the cash into C-17s at Andrews Air Force Base, flew it to Baghdad International Airport, and then a lot of it disappeared after it arrived in Baghdad.
Now, this is above and beyond the story of the duffel bags, right?
Yeah. I mean, this is industrial scale thievery. where, you know, billions of dollars in cash on pallets sent from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York just disappeared. And what I found in the book was that there had been a secret investigation that had identified a bunker in Lebanon where nearly $2 billion of that was identified and has been hidden by the people who stole it from Baghdad.
And so we know there's this bunker there with $2 billion in stolen cash. What happens then?
Well, the Special Inspector General for Iraq, Stuart Bowen, who investigated this, tried to get other people in the U.S. government to do something about it. Nobody wanted to go after it. Nobody cared. By the time he discovered this bunker, the Obama administration was already in place, and everybody by that time just wanted to forget about Iraq. And the Iraqi government knew about it, too. Prime Minister Maliki talked to Bowen about it, and they never went after it. And it's clear that there were some powerful Iraqis and powerful Lebanese money launderers who were behind this, and nobody really wants to rock the boat and make the effort to go get the money.
And I mean, that $2 billion is just the tip of the iceberg of the money that is gone. I mean, first off, whose money was it? What was the theory behind this? And where do you think the rest of it is?
Well, then the theory was this was money from Iraqi government accounts in the United States that had been frozen or had been built up to hold Iraqi oil revenues from Iraqi oil sales. And so it was the CPA, the Coalition Provisional Authority, which was created right after the invasion and was run by Paul Bremer and the Bush administration, decided they needed all this cash to jumpstart the Iraqi economy. But they just flew it all over there in huge Air Force transport planes and then drove it down Route Irish in Baghdad to this green zone, and then it largely disappeared. And there was virtually no accounting, no record keeping, no nothing, and no oversight. And since it was not U.S. taxpayer money, nobody in the Congress really cared about it. And the only person in the U.S. government who cared about it was Stuart Bowen, the Special Inspector General. And he pursued this for years.
And where, you know, I mean, when you speak to him, I mean, what is his perspective on all this? I mean, that's a sort of fascinating. There's a couple of figures in your book, and we're going to talk about them in a moment. But I just wonder, you know, for those people who have this perspective, and I think, mm-hmm. you know, these types of people we're seeing, you know, maybe we're just more conscious of them, maybe, because I would even, you know, I would say the long line of whistleblowers we have, these people who mm-hmm. sort of become disillusioned and just see, like, you know, wow, there's just no, you know, all.
Well, you know, what I think I tried to show that in the book is that, you know, after 13 years of the war on terror, we've, you know, gone from what you might have called a search for justice in the beginning to today it's a search for cash and power. And we've created a mercenary class of people who now make a career off the war on terror. They want to get rich, or they want to get ahead in the government, or they want status and power. And that's what endless war does to a society, is it creates a mercenary class that feeds off of war, and it helps this, you know, vicious cycle of making sure that we never get out of a period of war.
One figure who also stuck out as we move from sort of, I guess, thieves into con men is Dennis Montgomery. And
right.
this character, you know, a buddy of mine wrote a book about Sam Israel, who was the hedge fund and the parallels here, you know, mm-hmm. between the financial sector and mm-hmm. this, I guess, industry, if you want to call it, you know, there's just so much money floating around.
Right. And, yeah. I mean,
go ahead.
That was one of the things that I tried, that kind of the, what I tried to look at was how, you know, when Dick Cheney said the gloves come off right after 9/11, what that really meant was we were deregulating national security. And at this, and so all the rules came off. And all the rules came off at the same time we poured hundreds of billions of dollars into counterterrorism. And so you had a deregulated national security apparatus in which we were pouring hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars. And so you had enormous unintended consequences. In my opinion, it's kind of like the banking. We had a national security crisis, kind of like the banking crisis. And you just, everybody realized there was a gold rush going on in Washington. If you wanted to get rich, go to Washington and call yourself a counterterrorism expert. And that's what Dennis Montgomery did.
And well, tell us about him.
Well, he's just a fascinating character. He was a self-styled, he says he was a computer expert, and he created a company, a technology that he said would allow him to detect objects on the video of Al Jazeera news broadcasts. And he claimed that he had the ability to find inside the banner on an Al Jazeera newscast, he could find the identity of, or he could find numbers and codes. And working with the CIA, he gave the CIA information that he claimed showed that there were a whole series of numbers hidden inside Al Jazeera newscasts that the CIA took to mean a series of flights that were going to be attacked by Al Qaeda. And in the Christmas time, 2003, the CIA took this so seriously that President Bush ordered a whole series of flights, international flights to the United States, grounded based on what Montgomery was telling the CIA. And the flight, some of the flights were from France, and the French intelligence didn't think this was very funny. And so they demanded that the CIA tell them what kind of source or what kind of information they were getting. And after the CIA finally told the French where they were getting this information, the French intelligence got a French tech firm to look at this, and they came back and said, this is a hoax. And finally, after a while, the CIA was convinced it was a hoax, and instead of admitting they made a mistake, they just covered up the whole thing and never talked about it for years.
And wasn't it the case, too, that, I mean, this company, he formed a company, right? Via Dick Cheney got it sort of like passed around. Like there was, the Air Force was still into this technology well after that.
Yeah, yeah. That's the amazing thing is that even after the CIA became convinced that this was a hoax, he got contracts with the military and even into the beginning of the Obama administration. And, you know, in, there's some evidence that in 2009, if you remember, there was a supposed threat from Somali terrorists against Barack Obama's inauguration. And, you know, there was some evidence that this it turned out to be a hoax. And there's been some evidence that that may have come from or Montgomery may have played some role in that incident, too.
And
so it's something that's gone on for a year. I mean, it went on for a long time.
And wasn't it the case that George Bush contemplated bombing Al Jazeera because of this information?
Well, what they considered was shooting down airplanes over the Atlantic. There was a meeting that was described that I describe in the book between at the White House in the week after Christmas 2003, where a top White House official discussed whether they should shoot down planes that are coming to the United States based on this information. Luckily, that never happened. But that was the level at which, you know, this was being taken very seriously.
But didn't anybody at the CIA say, hey, you know what, this is an interesting story you're telling us, but maybe we should just double-check this with some other firm? I mean, this just seems like... I mean,
well,
thank goodness.
That's one of the ways in which secrecy really can be leads to abuses. Where if you keep everything secret, then no one knows. Then very few people know about it. And I think that was one of the cases here. It was kind of a case where only a very small handful of people were read in on this program. And so, and only those who kind of accepted the basic premise of it were allowed to know about it. And because you kept the information about it so small, all people knew was the CIA has information about possible threats, and that nobody, or very few people, knew where it was coming from. So very few people could question it.
So how does that work from a bureaucratic standpoint? Like Montgomery approaches somebody he knows in the CIA through probably some intermediary. I've got
it's a very complex set of relationships that led to him getting in with the CIA. And I detail those in the book. It's very complicated, and it goes through a lot of different people. And I think it was because of those relationships that he was taken seriously. It led, you know, through Congress and through lobbying firms, and it was just a whole series of people who, you know, who worked with him at different points. But he even got a meeting in Cheney's office when he was trying to get more contracts.
And what do you think drives? I mean, because I've had some experience in the early days of Air America. Which was founded, with all due respect, by a con man. And it is interesting to see, like, you know, where the type of people who enable that person. In other words, you know, they have an agenda, too. And a con man usually comes in with the answers that provide it. I mean, because I'm trying to cover this spectrum of what has been created by this sort of just pile of dumb money, essentially.
That's what I think. I think that's the basic problem here is we had, as I said, the U.S. decided, we panicked after 9/11, and we decided, you know, we're going to pour money at this problem of terrorism on an unprecedented level. And so we were basically throwing money at the CIA and the FBI and creating new agencies like Homeland Security and just giving them hundreds of billions of dollars, and it was more money than they knew what to do with. And so they were trying everything, and it was really crazy, and they really didn't have much. They didn't put much thought or didn't have much oversight. Nobody wanted, you know, and it's still true today that no one wants to do serious oversight of counterterrorism, because if you criticize them, you're considered soft on terrorism.
And in some ways, it goes deeper. I mean, this is the sort of the dynamic with Thomas Drake in some fashion. Mm-hmm. His whistleblowing was really more whistleblowing, not so much that something was happening that was unconstitutional, although there was some, you know, elements. But it was really like, this is a huge waste of money. This is just corruption.
Right. And that's one of the things, like, that's kind of what I'm talking about, is that by keeping everything secret, you enable these, you know, programs to continue without any question. And that's when I talk about the war on whistleblowers in the book, that's really kind of what the end result of the crackdown on leaks is that you make sure that there is no oversight by suppressing the truth and by making sure everyone is afraid to ever raise any questions about anything. And so when Drake and Diane Rourke, another whistleblower that I profile in the book, you know, when they try to raise questions, they get persecuted and the FBI raids their houses.
And let's just put a coda on Dennis Montgomery. I know people are wondering, like, whoa, okay, this guy bilked the U.S. government out of millions of dollars, almost had us shooting down our own planes. What jail is he in?
He's not. He's not in jail at all. He's never prosecuted for that. He was, as I said, he got contracts for a long time.
The ultimate irony is, I think that the only prosecution I think he was subject to was some type of card counting scheme in Vegas or something, right?
Well, he had some gambling bills. That led to
fraudulent checks, I think it was now.
Yeah.
All right, so tell us about Larbus.
Well, that's a fascinating story where it was a covert action operation with Special Operations Command and the Pentagon, in which they set up a fake company to provide, supposedly to provide intelligence for the Pentagon in the Middle East. And what I found was that one of the people being used in this operation was a Palestinian who told some other Americans involved in the operation that he wanted to find a way to launder hundreds of millions of dollars. And in one case told one of the Americans involved that he wanted to use the bank account set up for this covert action to launder as much as $300 million. And then I eventually found out that the FBI was conducting an investigation of this operation and the allegations. They'd heard some of the same allegations. And I had a very weird meeting with the FBI where they agreed to come in and let me talk to them about what I had heard, and also in exchange, they were supposed to tell me, you know, kind of as a trade barter, some information back and forth about what both of us had heard about this operation, because it was so secret. Nobody knew about it. And I go into this windowless conference room at the Hoover Building, the FBI headquarters, to talk about their investigation and what I found. And I start talking about what I found about this operation and this money laundering allegations. And after I finish, you know, I'd been told that they would be willing to tell me what they knew, and they all just stare at me. It's like seven FBI agents who wouldn't give me their names, just stare at me and say nothing. And then I keep talking for a while, and then I look up again and ask them a question, and they all just stare at me and don't say a word. And it was one of the most bizarre meetings or interviews I've ever had inside the government. And it convinced me, and I later found out, I later had it confirmed that they were conducting an investigation, but it just showed me how sensitive and difficult it was for the government to investigate these kind of secret operations.
Just because they were terrified of discussing the thing?
I think so.
Or do you think it's possible they didn't even know what you were talking about? I mean, on some level, I imagine like they're just sitting there going in for a completely different program.
No, I don't think so.
Okay,
I don't think so. I was later told by someone that meeting became legendary within the FBI.
Just because of the amount of information they didn't have?
No. They just didn't want to tell me what they were doing, and I later had to confirm that they were investigating the same thing, and they just had decided they weren't going to confirm what I knew and weren't going to respond to me. It was just a very weird meeting.
Let's talk about Diane Rourke, because this is a whistleblower that I had not really heard of until your book, and it's another fascinating story of someone who, you know, realizes not just the emperor has no clothes, but there's a lot of naked people.
I mean, I think she is, she's kind of one of my heroes. She really tried to blow the whistle inside the government, never leaked to the press.
Well, tell us
Diane was the House Intelligence Committee staffer in charge of oversight of the NSA at the time of 9/11. And she was a Republican staffer, and she had worked in the Reagan White House and then had gone to the Hill. And she was told by some people inside the NSA right after 9/11 about the fact that the NSA had started a secret domestic spying program, and which we now know as the broad domestic surveillance operations. And she figured at first that this was a rogue operation, that it couldn't be approved by anybody. And so she went to the chairman of the staff director of the House Intelligence Committee and the ranking minority staff director and told them about it, because she wanted the chairman and the ranking member to know about it. And they came back after she told them about it and told her, don't ever talk about this again. And then she realized that the chairman already knew and the ranking member already knew, and that they were keeping it quiet from everyone. And then she started going around to other people she knew in the government top CIA officials and people at the White House and people, you know, in other parts of the government. And she found that all these very senior people who she thought would help her secretly already knew about the program and were keeping quiet about it. And she got very depressed, and she finally had a very dramatic showdown with NSA Director Michael Hayden, in which she went to see Hayden at his office and told him, you know, this is illegal. And he basically told her, well, we have the power to do this. And he said to her in kind of chilling form, says, we can get the majority of 9 if we need it. And she took that to mean, if it goes to the Supreme Court, we'll have majority on the Supreme Court in our favor. And so she then left and tried to get to the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, William Rehnquist. And she sent a note through a family friend and never heard back. And she became very depressed and quit the government and retired. And then a few years later, when our story in the New York Times came out disclosing the existence of the program, she became the prime suspect inside the government of who had leaked. And her house was raided by the FBI, and she was persecuted, even though she had never talked to the press.
And I mean, that part about the 9 justices is one of the most chilling things
right.
I can imagine. Yeah. I mean, that sort of granular, like there's going to be 6 of us who decide
right.
this is legal. I'm
right.
one of them, says Hayden, and the other 5 are these Supreme Court justices.
Right.
Have you talked to her? I mean, like what, where is she now? Why is she continues to, it seems to me, not tell her story? Or has she told it through you now?
Yeah, well, she's very shy. She never wanted to talk very much. Now, you know, I think this is the first time her story has really been fully told. Part of the problem is just simply she lives out in Oregon now, and she lives a very quiet life. So, you know, a lot of reporters don't track her down. Because she just wanted to get away from everything.
And in fact,
to me, I mean, she was like, there was a whole group of people, as you mentioned, Tom Drake and others from the NSA who were persecuted. And I think her story is one that is kind of a perfect example in my mind of someone who tried to blow the whistle the right way, that the way the government says you should blow the whistle, you know, which is to stay within the system. And she still got persecuted. And so to me, it kind of says to all those people, if you think Edward Snowden could have stayed here and did what he did, well, you should look at what happened to Diane Rourke.
Right. And let's talk about that, because Thomas Drake, in some respects too, or you, I think, speculate that much of the I don't know what to call it, the persecution, if not prosecution, of Thomas Drake was a function of a belief that he was your source as well.
Yeah, that's not speculation. That's a fact. I got the search warrant that the FBI used in the raids of those houses of all those people, and they identify. They say this is part of an investigation into who leaked to the New York Times for their stories on the NSA by James Risen and Eric Lischblau. It says it on the search warrant.
And what's fascinating, though, is that, in fact, the case that you're dealing with now, and I'd like to, if you don't mind, to talk about that a little bit now, because I don't know that people are fully aware that, despite the fact that that was the sort of the most renowned story of that era, and I hopefully people know that this is a story that was essentially, I mean, is it fair to say, is suppressed by the New York Times on multiple occasions, and they only decided to run it when you basically said, I'm putting in my book. And they basically said at that point, well, I guess the cat's going to be out of the bag. We might as well get a couple of, we may be able to sell some papers out of it. But that NSA story, the story of the warrantless wiretapping, is not what you're being prosecuted for now.
Right, right. Well, I'm not being prosecuted. I've just been subpoenaed in a criminal case. But it's a case where you refuse to reveal
your source and could very well go to job to jail for it. But,
tell us what that case is. I've always thought that the real reason they were doing that is because they were upset at the NSA story and that they just were looking for other things to come after me on. I think they decided, the government decided not to come after the New York Times on the NSA story because that would have led to a real major constitutional showdown with the New York Times, and I think they didn't want to do that. And so I think they looked for other things that were just in my book and not in the New York Times.
And they basically settled on Merlin.
Yeah, I know that they investigated several chapters in my book. The FBI questioned any number of people about several aspects of the book and then settled on one chapter about a flawed CIA operation in Iran in which the CIA tried to give flawed nuclear blueprints to Iran, but in hopes of trying to derail the Iranian nuclear program, but the Russian defector they used to give them to the Iranians immediately saw that they were flawed, and he warned the Iranians that they were flawed so that they were tipped off about the whole program.
And so ostensibly, like, what is the concern there? I mean, and what the primary case here that I guess it's who leaked that information to you. I mean, what damage is there to national security to report what the Iranians already know?
Well, I don't think that in the whole history of the war on terror that there's been a single news story that's harmed national security. And I think that's the government cries wolf about these things all the time. They never show any damage. I mean, if you think about it, we're like the only superpower in the country, and they seem to be worried about a few reporters, and it's just really kind of ridiculous to think that this can harm national security. You know, any kind of news story can harm national security of the world's only superpower.
I mean, what do you think? I mean, you know, and I guess maybe I already know the answer, and it's embedded in your book, but how do you divide up the agendas that drive that belief? In other words, how much of it is sincere? How much of it is, I want to make sure that people don't realize I'm involved in thievery or incompetence or, I mean, because that I think is, you know, I think that's the part of the story. And I know your book, mm-hmm. you know, addresses that, but I think that's mm-hmm. the part of the story, the people that is the most, in some ways, the most accessible, because everybody who works at any type of big corporation or even small corporation sees this on a daily basis.
Sure. Well,
Jim blew it. And so
imagine, you know, where whatever company you work at, and imagine that everything in the entire company is secret from everybody else in that company, and that only like five people know about any particular thing going on. Imagine how screwed up the company would become because of all the abuse and waste and fraud that would happen if no one, not even people in the building, and no one, certainly no one outside, could ever know anything. That's a recipe for abuse, and that's what's happened. People have used secrecy to cover up embarrassments and mistakes and errors in judgment and thievery and fraud.
And I mean, it's almost a self-reinforcing loop, right? We've got to keep it secret
you can always say it's in the name of national security, that no one can know what I do because I'm really important.
And lastly, just put into context for us so that people understand why you are willing to go to jail to protect the source. I mean, the importance of the type of reporting that you and others like you do, and why that principle of protecting the source is so important to that job.
Well, I think it's the only way to continue to do aggressive investigative reporting. You got to have reporters need the confidentiality of sources in order to continue to do aggressive investigative reporting. And if we don't have that in our society, then you know, we'll have more abuse, more corruption, and far less transparency. And so I think it's really vital.
Do you think the American public has less of appreciation than they used to of that dynamic?
Yeah, probably. It's not there's not much of a constituency for the press or the media. People hate the media. So we're an easy target. And but, you know, I think they might miss it if we were gone.
Yeah, indeed. I'm just curious as to what do you think has changed in society that they're not that, you know, today's Dustin Hoffman is not playing you in a in a film.
I think you know, we brought that on ourselves. There's a lot of things to hate about the media today. So, you know, you look at the tabloid nature of most media, it's pretty ugly. So I can't defend all the media either. So, but, you know, with the bad, you got to remember that people still do reporting that's important. And so there's a lot of really good reporters out there that need protections like this.
James Risen, the book is Pay Any Price, Greed, Power, and Endless War. We'll put a link to it, of course, at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today, and thank you so much for the work that you've been doing as a reporter. So much of what I have been talking about over the past 10-some-odd years is directly a function of your willing to do this type of work and willing and to have this level of dedication towards it. And so I thank you both, I guess, professionally and as a citizen.
Oh, thanks very much. I appreciate that.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, and I will play the outro music from this break because Michael is in a near state of panic as he's staring at the. Well, he's just looking. The way that Michael exhibits panic is he almost like shuts down. He's like almost. He goes into one of his yoga trances, and all is well. And that's just the way. He just eliminates the stakes of everything around him, and he just get very zen-like. It's like it's like taking a lot of serotonin inhibitors or something like that. That's the way you work.
That's interesting.
Folks, we're going to head into the fun half in a moment. Please, just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. If you can become a member, I'm sure there are other places where you could hear James Risen for a half an hour uninterrupted, but not too many places. And, I mean, I suppose you're out to dinner with him.
Right.
But for those of us who don't have the opportunity.
If you're regularly having dinner with James Risen, don't worry about giving us money.
Right. Don't worry about supporting the show.
Yeah.
But then there's other people.
Yeah, and Elliot Spitzer. And he hasn't been on for a really long time.
No,
I don't know why he's the first person that comes to mind.
Strange. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back after this. We've got some sound, some stories. We'll take your phone calls, 646-257-3920 is the number, 256-257-3920. You can IM me. Also, pick up the app at majorityapp.com. We're still waiting for another update, but it's working fairly well at this point. But iTunes is slammed because I think iOS 8 is a nightmare for them. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll be right back after this.
the caller number 2 with